frighteningly, many of them. Equally scary is another way in which they achieve their purpose. By putting up enough believable disinformation and hoaxing enough events, they are able to persuade researchers to accept these bogus events without question and then report them to the public in various magazines and books. The vicious cycle continues. The public unthinkingly accepts these reports as reality. It is a complex issue, but it is very easy to fool people if they don't know there is a faux phenomenon or false phenomenon paralleling the factual and actual extraterrestrial phenomenon. With unlimited funds and sophisticated electronics and technologies, it is easy for this rogue clandestine group to do that. This group has enormous resources, while on the other side of the equation is a poorly funded, amateur, hobbyist UFO civilian community. It is like taking candy from a baby. This is a rule of thumb that you can go by, if there is a lot of money behind it, and if there is a lot of fearsome, scary, spooky, almost demon, like information associated with it, you can be assured that it is disinformation that has wittingly or unwittingly been proffered to the public. Many people don't realize that in cases of, say, animal mutilations, the vast majority have reports of unmarked helicopters and human commando-style operations doing these events. This is well known in the research community, but these facts never get reported to the public. The event is always portrayed as an alien mutilation of our innocent live stock. Think about this. We have a public that loves to go down to McDonald's and eat hamburgers. And this public is being informed that evil aliens are invading and torturing our poor cows. Come on. There is a psychological warfare component to all this. The people who trade in these scary scenarios find out quickly that if they go the direction of negativity, they get a lot of funding and grant supports from certain quarters. If they don't go negative, or if they begin to tell the truth, all their financial support dries up. This is precisely why XETI and the Disclosure Project has never had any serious funding. We refuse to lie about these things. We refuse to go negative. And we refuse to put out information that scares the hell out of the population. I have said publicly that if I were to write a book that said I had been abducted and kidnapped, vivisected or sexually molested by fierce extraterrestrials from Tau Epsilon, I could retire a very wealthy man. The book advances, the screenplays and the media deals would be extremely generous. That's the truth. Now, back to the story. I left the Rockefeller Ranch and went direct, literate Patterson Air Force Base with our military advisor and one other gentleman and met with a Colonel Canola and Bruce Ashcroft, a civilian intelligence officer also considered a public information officer. We did not go there to view the extraterrestrial bodies or material that had been there since the 40s. The purpose of the visit was for me to do a briefing to them about what we were doing and how necessary it was for them to be ready for change. You will remember how the admiral at the Joint Chiefs of Staff had ordered the meeting, and actually had to pull rank with the head of Air Force Intelligence to make it happen. The meeting went on for an hour or two, during which time I made a very clear case regarding how we had established contact on numerous occasions with the UFOs in question. They were writing furiously as we disclosed this information to them. We continued to explain that it was well past time for this information to be disclosed to the public. At one point, the colonel asked, "Well, what if these life forms are hostile?" I looked at him and I said, "You know what? You and I wouldn't be having this conversation if they were hostile, given the fact that the technologies that they have are so advanced that they can alter the fabric of space, time. If they were hostile, in a nanosecond the Earth could be turned into a cinder floating through space and you know it. And in so far as we have been doing reckless and dangerous things against them for decades, the fact that you and I still are breathing the free air of Earth is abundant testimony to their non-violence." He just looked at me. We left briefing materials at Wright, Patterson AFB with these officials. Later, my military advisor was able to get into the computer system and see that all these materials were accessible in the archives of Air Force Intelligence at Wright, Patterson. The XETI contact events and our best available evidence and assessment of the situation were all there, in that computer system. but after the material began to be accessed by higher-ups or their aides, it disappeared. Our material was never seen again. A little postscript to this experience. Later we learned that Admiral Kramer was told that he was not to be involved in this sort of meeting again. When our military advisor went back to visit the Admiral, his aide insisted, "Don't ever bring up that subject again with Admiral Kramer. He can't talk about that." Do you think that we should have been surprised to learn that? Shortly afterwards, he was promoted from being head of intelligence joint staff to being director of naval intelligence, DNI. I was told that Admiral Kramer was rewarded for not pushing this issue anymore. Hence, the promotion up to DNI. The bitter irony here is that he was probably given more information about the subject after he was rewarded for dropping the subject. Friend, saying that CIA Director Woolsey had made inquiries into the UFO matter and could not find out anything about it and was being lied to. Further, they knew they were being lied to. He told me that the CIA Director wanted me to come to Washington, and that I was going to be the first person to brief the CIA Director on this. Well, I thought that he had gone stark, raving, mad. I'm thinking, here I am, a country doctor in North Carolina, and I'm supposed to be going to DC to meet with the Director of Central Intelligence on something that is spook central? Right. To be honest with you, my initial reaction was that this had to be a prevarication. I viewed it as a cover story, that the CIA director knew everything and that he just wanted to find out what we knew and what we were up to. As it turned out, I was wrong, and Woolsey and the president really were out of the loop. On December 13, 1993, we went to Washington to meet with Woolsey. The cover story was a dinner at his friend's house. It was the six of us, the three couples, my wife and I, the CIA director and his wife, who, happily, was the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, so we were able to kill two birds with one stone, his friend and his wife. Our hostess, it turned out, didn't know who was coming to dinner until the day of the event. Can you imagine? Honey, guess who's coming to dinner? Oh, the CIA director and this extraterrestrial expert, Dr. Greer. Wow! Can you imagine coming home and telling your wife that? I remember arriving in the late afternoon at the CIA director's friend's house, with Emily. I had a whole briefcase full of materials. We discussed what we were going to do, but I had no idea how long this meeting might be. We all knew that this was a very serious briefing for the CIA director. He was being lied to about the most important secret in the history of the world. Woolsey's wife arrived first by private vehicle, and then the CIA director arrived via Secret Service escort. After initial greetings and about 10 minutes of going through some of the materials, documents, photographs, cases and so forth, the CIA director said, "Yes, I know these are real." It turns out that he and his wife had actually seen one of these UFOs years ago in New Hampshire, and so he didn't have any doubt that they existed. But what he wanted to know was, why wasn't he being told anything? And were there any current projects dealing with it? And why were the extraterrestrials here? And what does all this mean? People often think that senior officials like that would be laughing up their sleeve at this subject. But no. The man was visibly shaken. He was profoundly upset that as CIA director, something this important was being withheld from him and the president. He was extremely upset about it. At one point, I thought he was actually going to break down and cry. I considered his reaction an entirely appropriate response, given the gravity of the subject, and I was hopeful of the outcome of the meeting. The meeting that I thought might be half an hour or so, went on for nearly 3 hours. During that meeting, we discussed everything he wanted to know. And I told him why the extraterrestrials were here, and I explained why this was being kept secret. And I explained exactly what should be done to fix the problem. It was, I was acutely aware, a terrible responsibility to take on. I felt the gravity of this situation. I'm dealing with someone who is arguably one of the most powerful people in the world, and I find out the Emperor has no clothes. I find out that information is lost in the system and being denied to people who are running the most powerful country in the world. And then I find out they're not running the country at all, and that there's a shadow government that's really running the whole show, and that this is now being confirmed to me by a sitting CIA director. I went from being a complete skeptic that someone at that level of power and authority would really be out of the loop, to understanding how far out of the loop he was, and not just the CIA director, but also the president. It was then that I realized the severity of the dysfunction within what we think is a constitutional republic and a democratic type of government, to the point that there is flat, outlying to people at this level of constitutional authority and responsibility. I doubted that the CIA director, the president, and others who were being denied access to these projects were being lied to. But, because now I have been with people like a sitting CIA director and sitting members of the Senate Intelligence Committee and similar officials throughout the world, and seen their faces and their body language and their reactions, I can assure you that things are not what big media tells you they are. I shared with Woolsey the information that these extraterrestrial beings were here for peaceful purposes. I explained that many UFO sightings were of craft made by covert programs in the United States and elsewhere, that the technologies behind these vehicles are very powerful and are in the wrong hands. I also made the point that this matter had to be brought under constitutional control and it could only be done by the president. As a weak back, up position, the Congress could do an investigation, but really, because of the structure of the executive branch and its supervisory and immediate control over the chain of command, leadership had to come from the executive branch, the president. Toward the end of the meeting, I remember giving him a set of recommendations which we subsequently published. So here's the scene. I deliver the evidence into the hands of a sitting CIA director, recommend what needs to be done to disclose this information, end the secrecy, and get this matter back under proper control and oversight. I'm naturally hoping for some action, but what he asked me was, how do we disclose that which we have no access to? Disappointed, but still pressing the point, I said, you have to get control of it. You have to insist on access. He just looked away. He knew what was involved. During the time we sat down for our dinner, the CIA director was sitting across from me, and his wife was next to him. The group was discussing all these issues that had been raised. Finally, Dr. Woolsey, the CIA director's wife, asked, "Do you know how these craft communicate across the vast distances of space?" I remember going through a quick but agonizing inner gut check. Do I tell her the truth and lose all credibility? Or do I tell her a lie or a sanitized version of the truth and maintain some respectability? And I thought, no, I've got to just tell her the truth, as far out as the truth may sound. So I said, look, these extraterrestrial civilizations have figured out the structure of space and time and non-locality. I saw some puzzled looks and knew I had to explain in detail. It's like this, take our own galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, which is 100,000 light years or so across. A nearby star system might be 1% of the distance from us, which is 1,000 light years. Let's use that as an example. Look, if you had to communicate to that star system, and it had to return a reply, you'd have to say, hi, how are you? And they'd come back and say, fine, thank you very much, how are you doing? Just that exchange will take 2,000 years. How and why? A light year is the distance conventional electromagnetic waves travel, at 186,000 miles a second, over the course of a whole year. So, 1,000 light years means it'd take 1,000 Earth years for us to get a message there and another 1,000 to get the message back. And that's only 1% of the distance across our own galaxy. The speed of light is just too damned slow, I continued. It's not a viable means of communication or travel when you start talking about interstellar distances. Quite frankly, it's barely sufficient, if you're not over the speed of light, to go around even our own solar system. This means that any civilization that's gotten here has mastered those technologies and sciences that deal with everything beyond the speed of light, what I call the crossing point of light. If they've mastered that, they have discovered this nexus where electromagnetism, matter, space, time and consciousness all come together. It is, in fact, like the Moody Blues song, thinking is the best way to travel. I explained that these extraterrestrial civilizations have technology, assisted consciousness systems, as well as consciousness, assisted technology, where there's an interface between mind and thought and a specialized physics and electromagnetism. And so when they communicate, the message is communicated from point A, say here on Earth, back to a home planet, point B, 1,000 light years away, in real time. That's because it has dropped out of linear space, time and has crossed over into this non-local aspect of the universe. This involves some very sophisticated physics but also encompasses the realms of thought and of consciousness. They can think to a device or interface with a device, and it will instantly and accurately convey that signal and that message to another point, and this is technological, it's not just telepathic. The information and images are transferred non-locally to another point in space, no matter how far away, in real time. It is like two nodes, instantaneously resonating. The signal goes from one node to another, bypassing linear space, time. Dr. Wolsey looked at me and said, "I thought it had to be something like that." She really did get it. When you're dealing with civilizations that are traveling through interstellar distances, it is crucial to realize that they have had to master the sciences that involve consciousness, thought, electromagnetism, and non-locality. Hence, the XETI protocols have a component that deals with non-locality and consciousness and directed coherent thought. This is because the ETs have technologies that pick up coherent and directed thought signals as clearly as we would pick up an electromagnet, X signal from a laser or a radio or cell phone. It is very scientific and very reproducible. It is a science not widely known on Earth today. I think a lot of people can now understand this concept. Thankfully, there are now enough people who have arrived at a post-quantum understanding of the universe. A number of people I've worked with who have been in covert aero, space and electronics firms that deal with this subject have confirmed to me that we have retrieved extraterrestrial communication devices that do exactly that. They interface with thought and consciousness and respond to thought and consciousness. They are tuned to be able to do that. Well, the hours spent with the CIA director and his wife were certainly eventful and revealing. Toward the end of the evening, I sensed that he very much appreciated the information and was very interested. But I also sensed the profound tragedy and sadness in the moment when he asked me, "How do we disclose something we don't have access to?" I realized then the enormity of the challenge ahead of us. I recalled the dysfunction that we had been warned about by Eisenhower when he said, "Beware the military-industrial complex and the threat to our liberty and security by its excesses." What Eisenhower warned us about had fully matured into a level of dysfunction that was of truly epic proportions, and I was witnessing it firsthand. As we said goodbye, I realized that the entire time we had been inside, the place had been monitored. We saw there were Secret Service people out front. Of course, they had a SAG wagon and armed guards with earphones. The works. In many ways, the encounter was traumatic for me, but I was grateful because I was able to learn the truth. From the Senate Appropriations Committee. We met in the Senate Appropriations Committee meeting room, a huge, ornate room with a giant table and brass nameplates for each member of the committee. He proceeded to tell me, "I've been asked by Senator Byrd and some others to look into these things, and we've got 10 close enough to know that these projects do exist. But I'm telling you that with a top secret clearance and a subpoena power from the Senate Appropriations Committee, I cannot penetrate those projects." He looked at me, I'll never forget it, and said, "You're dealing with the varsity team of all black projects, so watch out. And good luck." And that was the end of that. Dick D'Amato and people like him know this is real, but they cannot get their hands around it or control the expenditures. Access to these projects has nothing to do with rank or position. Access has to do with whether or not you are willing to go along with the secrecy. That is the only criterion that matters, whether you are willing to play along with the agenda. Those who shouldn't be in control but are, comprise an illegal, rogue break, off group that is trans, national and whose members are not only ruthless and murderous but operating completely without any legal authority. When you're dealing with something as fundamentally important as this, involving technologies as powerful as those described, you begin to realize the risks to the world of allowing this masquerade to go on, unchecked, decade after decade after decade. In 1994, Ann Fop, a friend of Bill Clinton, came to my home after I had briefed the CIA director. He was a very easygoing, affable guy. He said, "You know, everyone agrees with what you're recommending, but there's a consensus that if the president does what you've suggested to him and to the CIA director, that they exert executive power to get inside this operation and disclose it, the president will end up like Jack Kennedy." I thought he was joking, and to be honest with you, I laughed out loud. I truly thought, oh, come on. But no, he was deadly serious. And he made it very clear that he was serious. So it went from crisis to crisis, as I came to realize that the government of the United States, and of every other nation, was really hostage to an illegal, rogue group that had technologies that could do circles around a B-2 stealth bomber and could, at will, terminate a presidency or terminate any other person who got in their way. This was made very clear to me by people who were in the inner circle of the greatest corridors of power on Earth. Obviously, this weighed on me very heavily. I would say the period between 92 and 98, those 6 years, were extremely traumatic for me. I would keep my chin up and publicly keep moving forward. But on a deep personal level it was devastating. I never lost faith in what we should do, but it was made very clear to me that the task was enormous and that the hour was late and that the stakes could not be greater. In early 1994, I went back up to New York and spent some time with Lawrence Rockefeller. I also met with a number of other people in New York City who were connected to the United Nations and to other organizations. We were walking into various circles of power and putting this information in their hands. In a way, I became the cosmic hand holder. I would sit with the wife of the Secretary General of the UN or a CIA director or close friends of the President or senior brass at the Pentagon and tell them what was going on and take them through this. It's like the stages of death and dying, where they'd go from denial to anger and shock and grief and everything else. And this was increasingly what I found myself doing. In these circles of enormous power and wealth, all kinds of betrayals happen. Some of the people working with us would sell out to a cell within the shadow government that interfaces with the civilian UFO community that's headed up by Colonel M.K., General T.E., W.B., a very wealthy Nevada businessman and others. One such person went behind my back, and tried to defame me to Rockefeller's people, to intercept money that Rockefeller wanted to use to support our project, to take into his own institute. So, here I am, working as an emergency physician, a very stressful job, raising four young children, and thrown into this nest of vipers. Traumatic doesn't begin to paint the picture. There were times when I really wanted to give up, but I knew I couldn't because I was still connected to the purpose and the vision of where we're headed. I tried to keep my sight on that far horizon, which isn't that far away in time, but seems very far away in events that have to happen, where we can create the world of our dreams. And it was with that certainty, as well as faith, that I stayed in the effort. You have to understand the compartmented nature of these interlocking interests that are keeping all this secret. They are mainly in the corporate, institutional, financial, and technology sectors. The government of we, the people, is the least important component of it, and this includes the military, the CIA, the NSA, the NRO, Army Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, All of that is window dressing for an operation that's quite outside it. The real action is a hybrid group that is quasi-governmental but mostly privatized and utterly trans-national, and completely illegal. Some of the chieftains of that group invited me to meet with them after I had met with the CIA director. In advance of the meeting with the CIA director, my contactor, Woolsey, was terrified by the idea that anyone would find out about the meeting. He was doing everything through FedEx, and he wanted me to talk with him on the phone at telephone booths, talking in a code. I said, "We don't need to bother doing that, because the group that we're up against have technologies that can frustrate any system you can devise." Well, he had been on the shortlist to be Clinton's Secretary of the Navy. So he knew the spook world fairly well. But he had been in the conventional military and intelligence world. I knew what we were up against, but he didn't. So he said, "Oh, no, we have to do this. You're just a doctor. I've been in all these circles, and we have to be careful." So I humored him. I tried to explain to him that there was no way to frustrate the surveillance capabilities of this covert group, because they had non-local, scalar technologies that would enable them to bypass entire generations of electronics. Even the state of their art NSA and NRO stuff is nothing compared to what they have, because what they have are electronic interfaces with consciousness, where they can monitor things in real time all the time. Well, he didn't know this. I knew it and had viewed them remote viewing me, so I went along with his game. But before I had the meeting on December 13, 1993, someone who had been tied into these projects in the military in Arizona came to me and said, "I understand you're going to be meeting with Jim Woolsey, the CIA director, about such and such on this date." I said, "I won't confirm or deny that, but isn't it interesting that you would comment on it?" I reported this to my contact, and had to pull him off the ceiling. He went ballistic. "How could this be found out?" I said, "MJ, you haven't been listening. The problem is, most people are too arrogant to know what they don't know." I should also mention that during my visit to New York in the winter of 1994, while at the Hilton on 6th Avenue in New York, I got a phone call from a reporter, and he said, "I'm a freelance reporter for the Wall Street Journal." He said, "I understand you had a meeting with Admiral Woolsey regarding UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence." He asked, "What can you tell me about that?" I didn't lie, I just asked a rhetorical question. "Do you really think a sitting CIA director would meet with a country doctor from North Carolina about a subject like UFOs and extraterrestrials?" And he said, "Well, no, I guess not." And I said, "Well, there you are," and I hung up. And that was the end of that. But this experience revealed to me that the media community was also mobbed up with intelligence people who were monitoring our activities. It was around this time, in early 1994, that a contract worker for the covert shadow group that had a cell within the CIA, called me and said, "Look, we really want to see you get this done. Hurry up." I said, "What do you mean, hurry up?" They said, "We've been wanting someone to appear who would do this for us. At least a third of the people in this covert control group want to see this matter disclosed, but we can't do it." I said, "Well, who the hell do you think I am? I'm just a country doctor here in North Carolina. I barely have a pot to pee in." He said, "Well, no, you don't understand. We can only do things behind the scenes." I said, "Oh, for God's sakes." Eventually, he flew in and met with me at the Grove Park Inn, in Asheville. I'll never forget what he said to me during this conversation. "You know, if you want to get a message to us or to the president, all you need to do is pick up the phone. Don't dial anything, just talk. Or if you prefer, just sit in your home office and talk to the four walls. Because it's all being monitored in real time." And I said, "Yes, I know." And he asked, "Well, how do you know that?" I proceeded to tell him how they had made errors and left their end of the hook or tap open a couple times. "It happened to Emily, and it's happened to me. Once when I picked up the home phone to make a call, I heard a control room on the line. I could hear people talking, instead of a dial tone. So I asked, "Who is this?"